I'm Marty Moscoen. Welcome to Radio Times. Matt Lauer's hosting of the Commander-in-Chief Forum last week has become a lesson in how not to be a moderator. He was criticized for not fact-checking Donald Trump when he said he opposed the Iraq war, for spending too much time grilling Hillary Clinton about her emails, for his friendlier questioning of Trump, and for not giving the veterans in the audience more time to ask their questions. The first presidential debate is in 2 weeks. It'll be hosted by Lester Holt, the anchor of the NBC Nightly News. The other moderators are ABC's Martha Raddatz, CNN's Anderson Cooper, and Fox News anchor Chris Wallace, who has said he didn't intend on being a truth squad. Well, that got us wondering, what is the role of the moderator during a live debate, especially a presidential debate, and for reporters and hosts of shows, for that matter, conducting live interviews? And we have two guests who have joined us on Radio Times. Brian Stelter is the senior media correspondent for CNN, host of Reliable Sources. And Brian, nice to have you with us on Radio Times.
Thank you. Great to be here.
Also with us is Alexios Manzarlis, and he leads Poynter's International Fact-Checking Network. And Alexios, joining us by Skype. Nice to have you with us on Radio Times as well.
Thank you. Nice to be here.
Nice to have you with us. Brian, let me begin with you. In this unpredictable, unusual, even bizarre election season, is there greater pressure on moderators to perform at a higher level under greater scrutiny?
I would describe it as the most pressure the moderators have been under in modern times. You know, think back to 1988. That's when this Commission on Presidential Debates started leading the debates every 4 years. They've made a lot of choices for moderators since then. Most of the debates have gone pretty well, but this year is going to be especially tough for the commission and for the moderators.
What do you see then as the role of the moderator? And we got a little taste of something last week, although it's not going to be the same when Hillary Clinton and Donald Trump and whoever else is there are all going to be in the same room at the same time.
They have multiple jobs up on the stage simultaneously. And because Donald Trump is up there, the challenge is more severe than ever. Add Hillary Clinton, and that makes it even harder. We know that Trump is unique, though, in terms of his use of the media and in his willingness to fight with media figures, fight with interviewers, argue with moderators. We also know, based on PolitiFact and other sources, that he tends to make more misstatements than other candidates do. So there's going to be pressure on these moderators to interrupt and to fact-check when necessary. However, in the past, most moderators have said, that's not our job. Our job is to have the candidates talk amongst themselves. If there's a misstatement, if there's a lie, the other candidate should be the one to push back. I think this year, however, that might be a bit different. Think about last week, Matt Lauer talking to Donald Trump when Trump lied about his Iraq war stance. Lauer did not follow up, and he was widely criticized for that.
And I do want to get you in on the conversation, Alexios, but let me go back to you, Brian. And I think a lot of people, even people who were not in the media, were watching that. I think 15 million people watched it. And the public largely knew what Donald Trump had said or not said about the Iraq war.
Yeah, that's right. We know, just to remind our audience at home, Donald Trump did not oppose the Iraq war publicly until after the invasion had begun. Nowadays, he says he was always opposed to the Iraq war, which seems to fly in the face of the facts. There are other misstatements, of course, Trump has made over the years, but this one is a unique one because it forms some of the basis of his campaign argument that he has better judgment than Hillary Clinton, and because there's so much public information about his positions on the Iraq war. So when Lauer failed to fact check that, I think it reminded us of the pressure that Lester Holt is going to face in 13 days. What will Holt do if and when Trump repeats that misstatement? Will Clinton interrupt? And if Clinton doesn't, will Holt interrupt? In some ways, Holt is in a no-win situation because half the audience is going to agree with his choice and half the audience is going to disagree with his choice. But my argument would be we've got to be on the side of the audience at home. We've got to be on the side of the viewers, the voters. And the voters need to know the truth about both these candidates.
Let me turn to you, Alexios, as someone who is deeply involved in fact-checking. What do you see as the role of fact-checking during either a live debate or even a live interview?
Yeah, so let me make two premises on this. I sort of feel for the moderators, right? They're in a damned if you do, damned if you don't situation. The moderators who have stepped in the past, Candy Crowley, John Dickerson during the GOP debate in February, have been also very strongly criticized for coming in with a fact check. I would also say maybe some of the criticism of Matt Lauer may be a little ungenerous considering just how many hosts before him had let Trump go away with this claim about the Iraq war, which has been so thoroughly debunked. That said, with however hard this situation is, with 60 million people watching the presidential debate, I find it really grating to hear moderators say that their job is not to fact check, that the opponent will be fact checking. I think that's incredibly naive. The opponent's fact check will include a lot of spin. If it's true, and the audience at home will either know even less or not know whether to trust it. Because of course, in fact checking someone else, if you have a motive for that person to be wrong, how can I know to trust you? That's the moderator's role.
Well, and in order to fact check, a moderator has to be prepared. It has to have done their homework to anticipate what a candidate is going to say, Alexios.
But, you know, like the talking point of the Iraq war is a recurrent one. All politicians will stick to some marching orders in terms of the messages they do. And so on those, I think it was Eric Wemple who noted, you know, fact checkers exist in part to help out hosts. This is part of the research process that goes into preparing for an interview. Are there talking points that these candidates make over and over again, which have been demonstrably inaccurate? If they are, and if it's, you know, black and white, a lot of the times with fact-checking, it may not be. That's why some of them have nuanced rating scales. Exactly. But if it is, then they should step in.
Brandon,
that's the complication here, is that most misstatements are complicated, right? Most lies or falsehoods are not black and white. What's different about Trump is that there are more of them that are black and white. That's why I think there's more pressure this year to call it out. Some of what Clinton says is untrue, but it's complicated. It's nuanced. There are arguments on both sides. What do you do in that situation if you're a moderator? That's a very, very difficult position to be in, which I think is why there's this tendency to say the candidates have to fact-check each other. And remember, Chris Wallace, who is the moderator of the last debate this year in October, He has said it's not his job to truth squad. We've not heard from Lester Holt, Anderson Cooper, and Martha Raddatz. They're the other moderators. So we don't know what their position is, and they're probably wise not to comment and let their work speak for themselves. We'll see, though, because Holt will set the tone for the whole season of debates.
Well, picking up on the fact-checking thing that you just said, Brian, and it's true. If you look at PolitiFact, you look at some of these other fact-checking organizations, you see more pants on fire, more Pinocchios for Donald Trump. And for a moderator, I'm assuming you want to look like you are, quote-unquote, fair and balanced. How do you suggest a moderator challenge someone if one of the candidates, in this case Donald Trump, says more untrue things?
Yeah, I would suggest that fairness does not mean treating both sides like they're equally good or equally bad. Fairness in an election like this means acknowledging what is true and what is not true. And we see that playing out every day with this notion of false balance or false equivalency. Hillary Clinton supporters feel like she is treated much more harshly by the press than Donald Trump. If you were to list make a list of each candidate's offensive and untrue statements, the list on Donald Trump's side would be longer. We know that because of PolitiFact and other fact-checking organizations. And yet, Clinton and Trump are sometimes treated like complete equals, equally horrible or equally offensive candidates. We all see the numbers about how they're both distrusted. So that's, I think, the challenge here. Fairness does not necessarily mean treating them like they're equally good or equally bad. And yet, that's what the political partisan argument will be during these debates, that they must be treated exactly equally.
What do you think about that, Alexios?
I mean, a couple of things. One thing I would note is that part of the criticism of fact-checking in the past during presidential debates, namely of Candy Crowley's fact-check, was that it sort of throws the balance off, right, by bringing in someone from the outside. And so maybe a more structured approach in which, and I know Glenn Thrush had suggested this on a Pointer interview, in which you go through at the end of the debate, say, three or four fact checks that have been made to those candidates. And so they know they will be challenged specifically about an erroneous claim that they've been repeating on the campaign trail. So I think part of the problem is that here, America, which has, and I'd say this coming from outside, America has really sort of invented this new phase of political fact-checking with factcheck.org, whatever, 12, 14 years ago, but has been a little behind on adapting it to TV, on realizing that it needs to be produced. It's not sufficient for a moderator to just say something at the possibly wrong moment and not be... you know, there's a question of whether the viewers will trust that intervention too. So there's a lot more than just the host that goes into good fact checking.
Brian,
if you don't mind, I just only because you both have mentioned Candy Crowley, and we do have this queued up. This goes back to October 2012. Candy Crowley is the moderator, a debate between presidential candidates Mitt Romney and Barack Obama. And Romney criticized Obama's handling of the Libya attack specifically for not saying the words act of terror on September 12th, 2012. And this was a day after the attacks in Benghazi. Let's give it a listen. And then, Brian, I'll toss it to you.
It was not a spontaneous demonstration. Is that what you're saying?
Please proceed, Governor.
I want to make sure we get that for the record, because it took the president 14 days before he called the attack in Benghazi an act of terror.
Get the transcript.
He did, in fact, sir. So let me call it an act of terror.
Can you say that a little louder, Candy?
He did call it an act of terror. It did as well take 2 weeks or so for the whole idea of there being a riot out there about this tape to come out. You're correct about that.
I mean, what we hear, Brian, is her saying in a not the most articulate way that both of them are sort of right.
Yes, and this is now cited as an example among conservatives of what not to do, of what's not appropriate. Conservatives believe that Candy helped tip the scales of the election potentially by supporting Obama in that moment and by rejecting Romney's view. Now, I don't think research-wise we can say this actually affected the outcome of the election. Obama had many, many advantages at that point during the race. But that is cited as an example of what not to do. Now, on the other side, Obama was calling on the moderator to back him up in that instance. Very difficult position for her to be in. And she was technically right that Obama technically used the words act of terror right after Benghazi's attack. However, the way he used those words and the way that he put it in the context, that can be debated and is still debated to this day. So I would say that's an example of not a black and white fact check. There are other issues in this campaign that are more black and white with regards to what Trump has said about Mexican immigrants and about Muslims and others. There are black and white issues that he may challenge that Clinton might fight back on. I just wanted to make one other point about fact-checking. When we say fact-checking, a corollary to fact-checking is really follow-ups. That's what makes great television interviews and great television moments. And whether Lester Holt and other moderators literally fact-check and say you're wrong, or if they follow up and probe further, either way, viewers are going to be better served. I think when I yell at the TV, I don't know about you guys, when I'm yelling at the TV
all the time,
it's because of a lack of follow-ups. It's because of a
Up
lack
to yourself,
of,
I hope.
Of yeah. Well, I actually do once in a while yell at myself. When I'm disappointed in myself on CNN, to tell you the truth, it's because I didn't follow up enough, and that's what I think we want from moderators this season: a lot of probing follow-ups.
Hold on to that thought, only because we do have to take a very short break, and that is Brian Stelter, senior media correspondent for CNN. He hosts the Reliable Sources on CNN. And Alexios Manzarlis is with us as well from Poynter's International Fact-Checking Network. We'll be right back. This is Radio Times here on WHYY in Philadelphia. I'm Marty Moscoane talking with Alexios Manzarlis and also Brian Stelter about moderators, the role of moderators during presidential debates, and live fact-checking or fact-checking the responsibility of fact-checking so many of these debates. And you can call us at 1-888-477-9499. A lot of comments already. Radio Times at WHYY.org. You can tweet us at WHYY Radio Times. Let me just read a couple of comments. An email from a New Jersey listener: the role of a moderator is to moderate, not to create or inject how they think. This is the media's problem today. A tweet from two: they owe it to voters to provide opportunity for the opponent to respond to a lie. Comment from Laura: there's a difference between moderating and asking questions. Lauer handled the forum as if he were biased, which is definitely a big no-no. A comment from Tim: I just hope Clinton and Trump don't come to blows the way this thing is going. Alexios, let me go back to you. And Brian was saying before the debate, and it's hard to argue with him, about the importance of follow-up questions. First, the original question where you're going to frame what it is that you want to ask a candidate, and then the listening that's involved and the preparation for the important follow-up question. Do you believe in, as Brian was saying, just how important this is?
Yeah, I mean, and I'd note that actually Chris Wallace, who has been the one who sort of attacked for saying that his role is not to Truth Squad, was actually one of the most effective moderators in the however many debates we've had in the primary season by asking, if I remember correctly, how would you pay for that? And putting up on stage a graph of the cost of a program, which unfortunately escapes my mind. But so, yeah, probing follow-up questions are great. And I'd also note that, again, graphs, videos, replaying Trump saying on the Stern Show that he was for the Iraq War, it's not enough to expect that viewers will trust the moderator. They need to bring their sources. They need to bring their evidence. Just like fact checkers online link to the primary sources or to the original video that proves that one claim is true or false, moderators should be doing the same thing if they want to be fact-checking. Otherwise, they risk increasing the confusion and they risk appearing biased or one-sided. And I understand that they want to avoid that risk.
Alexios, one of the things that you have written is that fact-checking on TV should use images and graphs. You just referenced that. Images and graphs more than words, for instance, and I saw, I believe it was on CNN, not true in parentheses under something that Donald Trump had said. You're saying images and graphs are more effective?
Yeah, I mean, I was a political fact checker on Italian TV, and my producer would repeat over and over again that I could put whatever I had behind me, and viewers would immediately believe and trust that more. It was a kind of support to what I would be saying. It's the difference between a talking head and a fact checker, is that you've brought your evidence. You are showing it to the audience, who shouldn't trust you per se, but should trust you as a vessel of the fact check.
Brent, and I'm assuming in a live TV debate or what we saw last week, that there are producers whispering in the host's ears about things that are being said or not said. Do I have that right?
To some degree, that's right. During the Matt Lauer interview last week with Trump and Clinton on stage, there should have been a producer in his ear giving him support. That's certainly what happens during primary season debates at CNN and Fox and elsewhere. It doesn't mean they're being fed what to do. It's really up to the moderators. They are in control. But you have the support, you know, from your team giving you guidance on what was actually just said. You know, just even for an example, just from my one show on CNN on Sunday, sometimes when you're in the moment, when you're doing the interview, you may not actually hear or understand the context or the consequence of what one of your guests said. So it's great to have a producer in a control room really paying close attention to every word, knowing when to follow up. Yeah, I'm sorry, go ahead.
No, if I can jump in, that's sort of what happened with Dickerson in the Greenville debate, where Cruz claimed there was 8 years of not confirming a Supreme Court candidate in an election year. Dickerson wasn't sure whether he heard confirmed or appointed. Mm-hmm. So there was kind of a back and forth that confused everyone involved. And that's where I think the producer is most helpful, right? Because they either have transcripts or have someone who's taking good notes, right?
Right, Brian?
The challenge during these fall debates is that Lester Holt, Anderson Cooper, Martha Raddatz, Chris Wallace, they can have support from producers, but they're not. These events are not produced by television networks, so they're produced by a separate commission. In other words, CNN, Fox, they're not the ones actually in charge of the debates. They don't necessarily bring their research staffs along with them, but Holt and others can bring along support. What I think is amazing about these debates is it's up to the moderators themselves to come up with questions, except for the town hall debate, where there's questions from the audience. So there's a lot on Holt's shoulders, a lot on Wallace's shoulders to lead and guide the conversation. They determine what topics, what questions are going to be asked, and they decide how much to interrupt and how much to follow up. I think there are going to be times in these debates where Donald Trump tries to run over Clinton and vice versa. So they're going to have to be a referee. They're going to have to be a traffic cop. They're going to have to be a reality TV host. And they're also going to have to be journalists who know when to follow up.
Brian, I'm looking at and actually remembering a bit of a disagreement that you got in with Sean Hannity. And this was over just how much speculation there was about Hillary Clinton's health. Interesting, now that she has pneumonia. I'm curious about why you pushed back so hard, which you did, and what you were saying even to other moderators and hosts about what they should do.
You know, my frustration with Hannity was rooted in an interview we had with Donald Trump in August, maybe even late July, where Trump talked about the rigging of the election. He actually was talking about Philadelphia.
Yes, he was.
And other alleged examples. You know, there's a lot of misinformation coming out of Trump's mouth on this issue. And I think it's incredibly dangerous to suggest that the election is going to be stolen from either party. It sows discontent. It essentially delegitimizes the results of the election ahead of time. What frustrated me about Hannity is that Hannity let Trump say it and didn't challenge him once, didn't push back once, didn't even ask him for evidence. He actually just ended the interview and said, thanks, Donald, thanks for being here. That, I think, is irresponsible. Even though Hannity clearly supports Trump and wants Trump to win,
he said
I think
so.
It's irresponsible. Yeah, that's right. I think it's irresponsible to let something so dangerous be said like that and go unchallenged. It's the role of the questioner, even a friendly questioner, to push back and to show the audience what's being said. And I have no doubt that Holt and Wallace and the others will push back if Trump were to say something so dangerous during these debates.
But that does raise a question about, or even the concern about, the sort of partisan media, Brian, that there are people that have chosen sides asking either friendly or unfriendly questions depending on who they're talking to.
Yeah, absolutely right. Another topic like this is Clinton's health. Trump has said that she doesn't have the stamina to be president. Hannity and other Trump allies have encouraged conspiracy theories about her health. I think there's two baskets, since baskets are in the news this week.
More baskets, right?
There's two baskets here. One basket is legitimate, important questions that I and you and everybody else has about Clinton's health. We want to know more about her past, about her medical records, and I think that's totally legitimate. What's not legitimate is this other basket of conspiracy theories that have been promoted for years that say she's secretly dying, that she has 6 months to live, that she's hiding an illness. There's no evidence of that basket. That's the National Enquirer basket of stuff. And Hannity was really veering over into that world in recent weeks, which, again, I thought was irresponsible of him because it actually misleads your audience. Again, I think this is all about who you serve. And these moderators, these interviewers, they serve the viewers. We, of course, have to bring some stuff to the table as well as viewers. We have to be critical thinkers and assess these debates on our own merits. But these interviewers, they've got a tough, tough job to do to serve the audience at home and help the audience understand the truth.
Alexis, how do you fact check something that Hillary Clinton said about a basket of despicables?
Yes.
How do you fact check that?
Oh, that's really interesting.
Yeah, I mean, there's sort of also a risk, right, of bringing fact-check to an absurd level, of trying to fact-check every single claim. Some claims are plain wrong just because they are morally wrong, they are politically wrong, but doesn't mean there is an objective approach. So I also don't think fact-checking is a cure-all for everything. I would note one thing to agree with Brian, that it is important to push back on gross inaccuracies, because as humans, we are hardwired to believe more things that we've heard more. So the more something, I think it's called the fluency heuristic, but we confuse fluency, so having heard something, with accuracy. And so that is something that needs to be addressed. And if just because someone, you think something is so patently wrong, doesn't mean you shouldn't hit back. So that's one thing. The other thing, if I may, is on partisan news. There was an interesting study that came out in August that showed that the more partisan news you read, the less likely you were to believe fact checkers, even though you knew their findings. So this study out of, Ohio State University, showed that even if you knew what the fact checks were, you would just not trust them. You wouldn't believe the scientists or the fact checkers or the journalists on issues of fact. So there is definitely a polluting effect of the highly partisan media.
And that's Alexios Manzarlis, and he is Poynter Institute's International Fact-Checking Network leader. And also with us is Brian Stelter, the senior media correspondent for CNN, host of Reliable Sources. And we are talking about truth and fact-checking and debates and the media and candidates running for office. 1-888-477-9499. You can also send us an email, radiotimes@whyy.org. And you can tweet us at WHYY Radio Times. Alexis, let me do a follow-up here. Are you saying that the more people hear something, whether it's true or not true, the more likely they are to believe it?
Yeah, yes. And that also poses a responsibility on the fact-checking, on the debunking, that the way it is debunked needs to actually provide the alternative story. As humans, we need, when if we have something in our head, we need an alternative explanation to fix it, to replace it, if we really want to dislodge it. And I would recommend anyone who is interested in this to look up the debunking handbook. But there's all kinds of ways in which humans are hardwired that make fact checking hard. From this to the confirmation bias, which makes us believe stuff that already goes in line with what we think. So even when fact checking, you need to do it well.
Brian, that's an occupational hazard for you, is it not? Or for anyone in journalism?
I struggle with this personally. Yeah, I would love to hear your all's thoughts. I don't know what the right answer is in some of these cases. Is it better to look into the camera, look straight into the camera, or speak straight into your mic and say, that is untrue? Or by doing so, are you giving it more attention than it deserves? And I haven't figured that out on a personal level. Let's give the most recent crazy example. The idea that Clinton had a body double stand in for her on Sunday morning so that when she walked out of her daughter's apartment, it wasn't really her, it was a body double helping her appear to be not so sick. Now, this is, it's a joke, right? It's a preposterous joke. And yet, if you look at your Facebook feed, I bet one of your friends has shared this idea on Facebook. So my thought is you got to look into the camera, as I did this morning on CNN, and say, that's crazy. It's not true.
Mm.
But by repeating it, are we making it worse? And I think that's the research that you guys are talking about. What is the right way to respond to these inaccuracies, knowing that some people want to believe them and will believe them no matter what?
Well, Brian, is there a point at which a moderator, a host, a reporter says that's a lie? Not that it's untrue, but that it is a lie.
The L word.
The L word, exactly.
The L word is the trickiest part of this of all.
Yes, it is.
The L word. Lie implies that we know what's in a person's heart. It implies that we know that they know they are wrong when they are saying it. There's times where I might lie to a friend, and there's times where I might make a misstatement to a friend, not knowing that I'm wrong. On something like Iraq, Trump has been fact-checked so many times that it's hard to believe he doesn't know the truth at this point.
Mm-hmm.
That's one where I think is tough. Another one, for example, Trump said that on 9/11, thousands of Muslims cheered in New Jersey and that he saw it. No evidence for that. So much evidence to the contrary. It's just not true. If he says it again in a debate, I think it's fair to say that's a lie because it's been so clearly proven to be false.
Yeah.
I think Clinton would interrupt in that case. Remember, Clinton's going to want to seize on Trump's inaccuracies, and Trump's going to want to seize on Clinton's. So some of the role here for fact-checking will be done by the candidates.
Right. Alexios, go ahead, and then we'll get some folks.
Yeah, sorry to interrupt you, Brian.
No, that's okay.
I'm half Italian, half Greek. I just – it's part of the DNA.
I think that's the
particular problem with some of the Trump inaccuracies is that he conjures these conspiracies that you can't quite show why it's not true. So to make a concrete example, Hillary Clinton has said, I remember going to Bosnia and landing under sniper fire.
Right, I remember that.
Like that was part of her testament as a foreign leader. And there was the reel of her coming to the airport and with Chelsea, a little young Chelsea and the kids and flowers. So you could easily dislodge it. How do you dislodge a claim that Hillary Clinton has a body double? Do you find all Hillary lookalikes in America and put them on stage and ask them one by one? This is the particular challenge, that
right. They're
so preposterous. Some of them are so preposterous. Others, with the unemployment rate, which she has said is, don't believe the 5%, it's maybe 28, I've heard 42%, that you can and should hit hard. And so it's also a question of being able to show your work and when you can and can't do it.
Let me get some callers in on the conversation. We've got Frank from Chester Springs joining us. And Frank, go ahead. You're on Radio Times.
Yes. Thank you, Mario.
I just
wanted to make a comment. I think you have to be careful about the format in these debates because that determines the moderator's responsibility. So in the debates that are coming up, if one candidate says something that's patently false, the other candidate is right there, 10 feet away, to rebut them, to take issue with that. So I don't think it's that's the moderator's job then. I think the problem with what happened with Matt Lauer was that when one of the candidates said something that was false, there was no one there to take them up on it except Matt Lauer. So I think that in that format, he had more of a responsibility. Any moderator has more of a responsibility to push a point back simply because the other candidate isn't there to do it.
Frank, that's a great point. Let me give Brian Stelter a chance to respond to that. And certainly in 2 weeks, it will be face-to-face.
Yeah, I think that's exactly right. That Lauer was in more of an interview posture. And every time these candidates are interviewed between now and Election Day, they're going to face some of the same scrutiny that Lauer faced. There's no doubt. Trump right now is mostly going to friendly outlets. So yesterday he went on Fox and Friends, the morning show. Then he went on CNBC with an interviewer who is pretty friendly to him as well. He hasn't been doing as many hard news interviews the way he was doing with Lauer last week. When he does do these hard news interviews, the same pressure is going to be on the interviewers to fact-check in real time. And because both candidates will be on stage together, there is more opportunity for the other candidates to rebut, which will be better for the viewers at home. At the same time, the moderators have to enforce the time limits. They have to give the candidates relatively equal amounts of time. Mm-hmm. There's so much going through those moderators' heads. It certainly is a damned if you do, damned if you don't situation.
And we're almost up on a break here. An email from Matt from Bryn Mawr says the difference between true or false is not a matter of opinion. Moderators are not engaging in bias bullying, keeping the senators honest or anybody honest. Alexios, any quick comment before we have to take this break?
I think when it's clear where the truth lies, and there are a handful of occasions where that may happen during the night, it's impossible to say the moderator shouldn't have some kind of role, even only in inviting viewers to go and see what the fact checks say. I'd note, like, if you were a Trump-leaning viewer or a Clinton-leaning viewer, would you believe the opponent's fact check of your candidate's claim? You wouldn't. So that's the problem. You need to have a third party that you trust to help you out with these claims, because you know that the two politicians on stage are, surprise, surprise, politicians.
Alexios Manzarlis is Leeds Pointer's International Fact-Checking Network. Brian Stelter is the host of Reliable Sources on CNN, where he's also senior media correspondent. And we are talking about the role of moderators and reporters in live events or hosts in live events, the role of fact-checking. 1-888-477-9499. Stay with us. We'll be right back. This is Radio Times here on WHYY in Philadelphia. I'm Marty Moscoen, talking with Brian Stelter and Alexios Manzarlis about moderating and debates. Let me play a clip from CNBC. We referenced this right before the break. Donald Trump responding to the controversy about Matt Lauer's moderating by proposing a new system with no moderators whatsoever.
I think maybe we should have no moderator. Let Hillary and I sit there and just debate, because I think the system is being rigged. So it's going to be a very unfair debate. And I can see it happening right now, because everyone's saying that he was soft on Trump. Well, now the new person's going to try and be really hard on Trump just to show, you know, the establishment what he can do. So I think it's very unfair what they're doing. So I think we should have a debate with no moderator, just Hillary and I sitting there talking.
I would watch that debate, Brian.
I would, too, but it's not going to happen.
No, I know that.
just so people know, you know, the commission's already chosen. But, yes, I do think it would be fascinating. On the other hand, who would enforce the time limits? Who would keep the conversation moving? How would we keep them from yelling at each other the whole time? It would be fascinating, but impossible, I would say.
What do you think, Alexios?
I'm trying to remember, was the West Wing, was Matt Santos and his rival, did they debate without moderator? I'm trying to remember. Because if they
going
did,
into fantasy land, yes.
Maybe we have a blueprint.
I wonder, Alexios.
Trump is doing something important there, though, in terms of working the refs. What he's saying is, I know they're going to be tougher on me, and I'm bracing for it. So he's trying to lower expectations for himself and raise expectations for the moderators at the same time by pointing out the criticism of Lauer last week.
Let's note that Clinton has been doing the same trick, though, right, this week with their fundraising emails saying, look at Lauer going easy on Trump. It didn't quite get to, oh, the media is so corrupt. But there was a bit of winking at the press. You can't trust them.
Alexios, are we going to have any time in our lifetime real-time fact-checking?
Yeah, I mean, again, with so many talking points being repeated over and over, some of this stuff can already be done, right? Like Lauer could have stepped in live with the interview of Trump saying that he was for the Iraq war, and then with a screenshot of his article on Esquire in which he was against the Iraq war in 2004 when the war had already started. So I think part of the problem is that we think that this stuff has to be researched there and then. You can actually do a lot of the work before. And that's how, you know, the pros, PolitiFact, the Washington Post fact checker, factcheck.org, they have a lot of their stuff in their databases already, and, right. and they'll whack it out during the night because they can have it ready. Can we get to real-time fact-checking of new claims? I think that's hard and probably impossible without some serious automation happening.
Let me get Leon from Winfield to join our conversation. Hi, Leon. Go ahead. You're on Radio Times.
Okay. The education system in our country has a duty to teach us to be critical thinkers. But I find that both parties want us to think emotionally and categorically. The scary part is that the politicians are running the education system. So there's some kind of conflict there.
Leon, let me take your point, and I'll put it to Brian Stelter. And I think what Leon is telling us is we don't have enough, perhaps, civic education, and the people think yeah. with their hearts, you know, perhaps less with our brains and more with just yeah. our feelings, our emotions.
Some of us do. I like to be optimistic and say that at least a lot of us, hopefully most of us listening, are critical thinkers, are able to discern from fact and fiction, are able to sniff out a lot of the BS of this election year. But it's true, and you can see it in your Facebook and Twitter feeds when you log on. A lot of people are in their tribes. They have dug in their heels, dug in their feet, and are not moving between now and Election Day. And to that, I would just say, the more media literacy and the more critical thinking we can apply, the better. This is an election where the media is such a big part of the story, where Trump is attacking the media, et cetera. So you've got to be media literate. When you're watching Sean Hannity's show, you've got to know that he's a Trump supporter and that's not news per se. It's a talk show. When you're watching these debates, you've got to know what everybody is invested in. So yes, I couldn't agree more with the sense that we need much more teaching of media literacy and of civic literacy in the country. I'd like to think a lot of people have it and they've got it down, but we do need more of it, and this election exposes that.
We have an email from Pam. How, why do we no longer have the unbiased, dignified format used by the League of Women Voters? I mean, I would say in many ways the upcoming debates, they have their rules. I don't know if dignified is exactly the right word, but Alexios, you're not from around these parts, but how do they do things in other countries? I'm curious.
Yeah, I mean, you guys are lucky because a lot of countries' candidates will refuse to debate full stop. So I think the last time we had a prime ministerial debate, which would be the equivalent of a presidential debate here in Italy, was either 2001 or 2006. And I can assure you there have been a lot of new governments since then.
Yeah.
It's definitely it is a really strong part of American democracy that you do have these opportunities to see the two candidates face to face, to have them three times. So I don't want to be all pessimistic about, this election, the facts, everything. I do think this is potentially a positive moment. And, you know, with 50, 60 million watching, it's or however many the sparring fight between Trump and Clinton will be able to bring, I think this is positive.
You know, Brian. Go ahead.
To the point about the League of Women Voters, they did run debates until the late 1980s. That's when this commission took over. And there are a lot of criticisms of this commission. It is bipartisan as opposed to nonpartisan. They disagree with me on that. But, you know, they do have to have 15% of support in national polls in order to make it on the stage. That most likely is going to keep Gary Johnson and Jill Stein out of these debates, even though most Americans want to see Johnson on that stage. So there are some strong critiques of the commission. That said, there still is enough of a consensus that both major parties do support the commission. Both candidates will show up at the debates. For the most part, you know, there is a consensus in support of the commission, and it'll be interesting to see after this year, after Trump, if that remains the case.
Let me read a couple of comments. An email from David. We seem to be living through a rising tide of ever more extreme political disinformation. Moderators who fail to confront blatant untruths run the risk of being seen as complicit. If Trump unleashes a multitude of lies and errors, does Hillary have to spend the whole debate just correcting him and never speak? The difference between true or false is not a matter of opinion. Moderators are not engaging. Oh, I read that one earlier. That was Matt from Bryn Mawr. Let me ask you, Brian, and we carry the BBC here on WHYY. I listen to British journalists interviewing either candidates or members of government. They interrupt. They ask hard questions. They seem to do a pretty darn good job holding these people accountable. Is there something American journalists could learn from the Brits?
There are times where I do think we could learn from the Brits and their interview styles. Here's the argument against it, though. A lot of Americans would say, and a lot of media executives would say, that viewers are not comfortable with or supportive of hostile interviewing, aggressive, interruptive interviewing, that it's something that British viewers are used to and are comfortable with, not that American viewers are. What I would say against that position is that in this election in particular, viewers are incredibly frustrated, incredibly anxious, and a lot of us are downright scared for a variety of reasons. And I think this is a time for more aggressive interviewing, for more forceful interviewing. The times that I've had Trump and Clinton surrogates on the program, my viewer inbox lights up when the questions are tougher and when the follow-ups are more substantial. I think that is, at least anecdotally, what I believe viewers and listeners want this year.
Well, in fact, I remember you interviewing, it was a Trump surrogate, and this was about
Jason Miller, his spokesman. Yeah,
yeah. This was after the Khan family and Donald Trump's criticism of the Khan family as they spoke at the DNC.
And in that case, I found that asking the same question repeatedly is helpful to the viewer because it shows the answer or lack of an answer. I have a lot of respect for the Trump and Clinton spokespeople because they have some of the hardest jobs in media today, some of the hardest jobs in politics today. And I'm really thankful that Trump people in particular keep coming on television, actually more so than Clinton representatives. Even this morning, Kellyanne Conway on CNN's New Day being asked questions again and again. But I actually think that's what viewers want in this election. There is some discomfort when the questioning gets interruptive, when it gets downright hostile. But I think viewers, more so than most years, actually want that right now because of the stakes of this election and because of the frustration on both sides with the other side.
Well, it is interesting, Alexios, because you've got one candidate that has been very open to being on, certainly on some TV programs or TV channels, cable or network, and another, Hillary Clinton, who is much more guarded and much more reluctant. Maybe some changes in the last couple of days, a pre-pneumonia diagnosis, to be a little bit more open to the press. But that does create an interesting imbalance, perhaps.
Yeah, I mean, one candidate is, a totally careless with the facts, and the other one is extremely guarded with the facts. And so the careless one, Trump, is easier in many ways to fact check because he just tweets and retweets whatever passes in front of his phone. But the one who's been more guarded doesn't mean that she hasn't been having a tough time with the truth, right? I mean, we've seen it with the email scandal. So it's a tough season.
Brian, how do you balance? I mean, these two candidates in particular, how do you balance, or can you balance, the truthfulness or untruthfulness of them?
I think the way that Alexius said it was really strong just there. Careless versus guarded. I think we can say directly to the audiences, as many of us have, Trump makes more misstatements than Clinton. Partly it's because he has more rallies, has more public events, and says more. There's more text for us to analyze. This is an election where we've got to call out what we see, and I believe that the audience wants that. I would say, to be optimistic, though, we're more informed than ever if we want to be. We have more access to more information about these candidates than ever before if we want it. Some of us have to go and seek it out. You have to Google for it. You have to search for it, and you have to vet the accuracy of those sources. But thanks to the work of fact-checking organizations and thanks to all the newspapers and websites and TV networks that are posting material online, there is an enormous amount of information we have to make our decisions as voters. And I'm thankful for that. I'm worried that not all of us are actually going to access that information and take a closer look at it and study it, but I'm glad that we have access to it.
Let me see what Steve from Newtown has to say. Steve, go ahead. You're on Radio Times.
Yeah, I just wanted to make a couple comments about, you've already covered some, but, you know, Matt Lauer is at a disadvantage, not just because of time restraints, but also because he doesn't understand the military or the VA system. So when he asks Trump about his plan to help veterans in this backlog and on the VA, basically Trump gives as his plan the definition of a program Barack Obama already has in place called VA Choice, which I'm a member right. of, where the member can go across the street, find a doctor somewhere else. Oh, it's already there, but he presents it. But Lauer doesn't know that, so there's no pushback. To his credit, he did bring up the sexual assault of women in the military issue and had this tweet about Trump saying, what did these geniuses expect when they threw men and women together? But again, he didn't push back with this totally misogynistic, antiquated way of looking at that issue and not saying, well, the UCMJ already, you know, forbids rape in the military, just like the civilian world. And by the way, men are also sexually assaulted, not just women. Well, so he allows this really antiquated and disconnected answer to a very serious issue.
Well, Steve, I appreciate the call. Brian, it sounds like you wanted to jump in, and Alexis, I want to give you a chance as well.
I think I've had a similar thought about Trump's comments about immigration and about deportations. There's a lack of awareness or a lack of acknowledgement of the president's existing plans and his existing actions against immigrants, against undocumented immigrants in this country. And when Trump makes these statements and the historical context is not acknowledged, it makes it sound like he's going to change something when in some cases he's not. I think we've got to do better as reporters telling people what is already happening with regards to vets, with regards to immigration, other topics, so they can better judge what Trump is saying he would do.
Alexis, you want to add anything to that?
No, I mean, look, this is the job of every host. If you're not prepared, find someone who is prepared in your staff, in your production team, in your research team, and help you research it. That's really no ex- when you have, again, a low of 14 and a high of 60 million people watching, you have a responsibility.
To do comment to that, let me read an email from Mike in Wilmington. Trump's entire campaign strategy is to overwhelm with a cloud of lies, misinformation, and obfuscation. Further, Trump will immediately shift from the moderator's question in order to give an answer to a question of his choosing. Hard for a moderator to deal with these unrelenting, cynical attacks, but not impossible. Not impossible, Brian.
Not impossible, and I have a lot of confidence in these moderators. I don't mean to be a cheerleader for the journalism team, but Lester Holt is as good as they come. Anderson Cooper, Martha Raddatz, Chris Wallace, Elaine Quijano, moderating the vice presidential debate. The commission knew what it was doing by choosing these moderators, and we know Lester Holt is working every day now preparing for this. You got to know in the back of his mind, he's aware he's going to have the biggest audience of his career 13 days from tonight. I hope he doesn't get pneumonia.
Oh, don't say that. And how much since you raised it, Brian, and we're almost out of time here, how much time should we spend on Hillary Clinton's pneumonia?
I think the important questions, we need to know more about her medical history. We also need to know more about Donald Trump's medical history. I think the answer to this is both sides have got to share more about their medical histories and also other issues like Trump's taxes. As much as Trump wants to put a spotlight on Clinton, Clinton wants to put a spotlight on Trump. And the right answer for us, I think, in the media is clearly to focus on them both.
Well, that seems like the perfect place to end our conversation. Brian Stelter, thanks so much for joining us today in Radio Times.
Thank you.
You're welcome. Senior media correspondent for CNN, host of CNN's Reliable Sources. Alexios Manzarlis, nice to have you with us on Radio Times as well.
Thanks for having me.
You're welcome. Joining us by Skype, and he leads Pointer's International Fact-Checking Network. He writes about fact-checkers, he trains fact-checkers, and he organizes conferences on fact-checkers or fact-checking, obviously living and breathing fact-checking. Go to whyy.org/radiotimes, and you can find out much more about the program. You can download a podcast of the show, find us on Facebook, follow us on Twitter, sign up for the newsletter, listen to us on satellite radio. I'm Marty Moscowane. Thanks for joining us.